I would like to
take a moment and introduce our next speaker. Some of you saw him last night. He was the first person in Selma. So he was the first to be beaten in Selma. And he laid the land for the rest of us who wound up in Selma and Dallas County. And now he's currently the chairman of SCLC Board of Directors, Dr. Bernard Lafayette. And also sitting next to him is Mrs. Lafayette, who was in Selma at the same time during that project. Dr. Lafayette.
When I knew Harkey and he took pictures, we always had bulbs that popped and smoke came out. That's how we were sure that the picture was taken, you know, when the bulb popped. Yeah, so he's really made a lot of advancement there with this new technology. Listen, this is really great. I'd like to say to all of you, I'm just overwhelmed. I never thought that I would live long enough to see this day when there will be a reunion, a regrouping of the people who made such a sacrifice and made that movement happen. I should tell you that when we look back and we think about contribution we made, some of us didn't record a lot of things because we were doing what we just felt that we should do just on an ordinary basis. We weren't thinking about making history. We were just trying to make it through another day. And that would be history. So every day was history for us. And for many others, our friends and our colleagues who also made the final contribution. And each of us who were in those rural areas back in the 60s, you're blessed to be here. Yes. Many of us were actually targeted. We may not have known it, but yes, but we made it. We got through. So that's why this event is so important. It's one of the most important events that's taken place for us in the last 50 years. That is to be here to share with each other and reflect back on those moments. We're all very young, and some of our relatives called us foolish and crazy, and we got labeled for what we did. But I just want to take a few minutes, actually, to put some things into context. Now, my particular involvement came out of the Nashville movement with John Lewis, Diane Nash, and Jim Bevel, and all those, C.T. Vivian, Jim Lawson. It was Jim Lawson who actually trained us, as you remember, in nonviolence. There's a difference between being in the movement and being in the nonviolent movement. A lot of folks moved. Okay, from one place to another, and that was really great that we were able to move. But the nonviolent movement made it possible for change, and that's the thing. And I want to contrast some of the things that happened back in the day and some of the things that are happening now in terms of putting those things in perspective. So I'd like for this to be more of a dialogue. I want to share some things with you, but I'm going to try to do that very quickly. And then we want to have some reflections in terms of the overall strategy as opposed to our particular individual contribution. I want to look at it collectively and as a group in terms of scoping it out and being able to see, okay, what actually made a difference. Because that's the lesson that we can take away from here. What made a difference? Or did it make any difference? Okay, so we have to really evaluate that. My particular role at where I am now is that I was involved in the Nashville movement reluctantly at first, because I was always very busy. I did not have time, you know, for any social stuff, that kind of business. I didn't get involved in any sports and all that kind of business, etc. Only in many later years I seemed to take up golf, but I talk more golf than I play. Okay, but I have lots of golf clubs stashed in different places. Yes, but so I was busy. In fact, when they had the sit-ins downtown, one of the jobs I had, even though I was a student on campus, American Baptist College, I had a job for 1 hour each day down at one of the restaurants downtown, segregated restaurant. And I used to go through the back door, and I used to wash the dishes and eat lunch and then pick up my little money and then go back to school. So most of the time, I didn't eat lunch at school, although it was paid for. I had a little job. So when I was leading the demonstration one time with my group, you know, we were assigned to different groups to go to different places. Like you would go to Crest, you would go to Woolworth, and you would go to Walgreens, and you would go here. I was assigned to go to a place. They locked the door and wouldn't let us in. So I said, come on, fellows, girls. Yes, you already got that figured out. So we went around the block and went through the alley, and I knocked on the door, and they were used to seeing me during the lunch hour knock on the back door. And, of course, they opened the door, and then I held my foot there and so the rest of the people could get in. But the manager was standing in the front with the door locked, looking out the window. And all of a sudden, he looked through the glass there, and there was some reflection, you know, behind him. And he turned that around, and the very people he was locking out of the front door could come through the back door. I have some questions about it, you know, in terms of the ethical, you know, thing. But it, apparently it doesn't bother me that much. But after all, I was an employee there, you know, and I felt kind of different. But I had to find a larger cause, and it wasn't just washing dishes during the lunch hour. The larger call was, and it was important, was being able to be treated equally and everybody else. Now, the reason I got involved in the movement in that kind of thing is because I wanted the older people in my family and people in my acquaintance who had gray hair. So it wasn't about the grandchildren having a better opportunity. It was about grandparents. Okay? Because they've lived all their lives being discriminated against. And goodness, what would it be like if they could go and now sit down and eat and be treated like a regular human being? So I could not wait. For me, I was anxious to hurry up and get this thing, segregation, you know, eradicated. So, yes, I've been to jail 27 times too, you know, all that kind of stuff. And I'm the one who always tried to avoid going to jail. 27 times. Most time I went to jail was to protect Jim Bevel. Oh, yeah, you know. I had to stay with him to try to see if we keep him alive as long as we could. We were in jail one time on the Freedom Rides, you know, after the Freedom Rides took place. We stayed in Jackson, Mississippi, so we could get some of the black people in the local community to get on board. Okay? Because they didn't even know how to get on the Freedom Rides. We didn't know that. And we were waiting for them to come, and they never came. And Ross Barnett put out on the front page of the newspaper that he congratulated the Negroes. And that was a proper name for, you know. So he really was, you know, giving them a lot of credence, you know, Negroes, for not joining with those outside northern, you know, communist agitators. Mm-hmm. So that's who we were then, right? Okay. And folks from the north, you know, everybody from the north, you know, came down there, even North Carolina. Yeah, every north, okay, yeah. So anyway, we got arrested, and once we got out, we stayed in Jackson. We had to go talk to the district attorney to get permission to stay in Jackson, Mississippi, because the policy was with Jack Young, who was the lawyer, was that the time any of these Freedom Riders got out of jail, they had to get out of town. So we got one meal, okay, at the steakhouse in Jackson, Mississippi, and then we had a ticket to get out. Jim Bevel and I went and negotiated, and they allowed him to stay because he was from Itabena, Mississippi. So he was already at home. So I was just visiting him, right? So, you know, we used to talk our way out of things, and we also talked our way into things, you know, together. Anyway, here we were, and Bevel was, you know, unusual fellow. And if you read John Lewis's book, he would say that that I was the only one that could argue effectively with Bevel. And what people fail to realize is that I did not argue with Bevel. That's why. I always asked Bevel questions, so he argued with himself. And of course, Bevel could argue either side, you know, because he was good. Did you know he got arrested on the south side of Chicago one time? Yeah, on a Saturday. He was just walking down the street, talking loud, and going just, he was something, really, well, he was trying to get straightened out, and he was just arguing with himself. Now, you know, Southside Chicago, okay, what's peculiar about somebody, you know, talking loud on the street? Now, you know, he must have really been performing, right? Yeah, so he got, they called the police. The people in the community called the police. And they arrested him, and they're trying to think of a charge, so they say disturbing the peace. I went to the trial that Monday morning in Chicago. And the judge said, you know, you were disturbing the peace on the street and you were talking loud. That was a charge. The policeman in there arrested an officer. And Bevel, they said, how do you plead? They said, you were arguing with yourself. Talking to yourself, loud. Bevel put his hand on his hip, ran back and looked at the judge. He said, Judge, Your Honor, Plato, Socrates, okay, are all dead. Who else am I going to argue with? Case dismissed. So most of the time I got arrested, it was really, you know, trying to hang with him, to try to keep him alive as long as we could, you know. Good, all right. So, Freedom Rides, sit-ins, poor people, no, Selma, Alabama. That's why John mentioned I was the first in Selma. The only reason I was the first in Selma is because they sent two teams of snake workers there already, independently, okay, to Selma, Alabama. And they came back with the same report to Atlanta, you know, to James Foreman, who was head of SNCC, and told him, said, we can't do anything in Selma. These were folks who had been on the Freedom Rides and folks who had been, you know, sit-ins and been arrested and beaten and all that kind of thing, some shot. Mm-mm. So we can't do anything in Selma. And both teams had the same reason. They said, in Selma, the white folks are too mean and the black folks are too scared. They didn't say scared. They're from the South, so they say scarred, which was the same as being scared. Okay? So, when I went to get my assignment, came here in Atlanta, they had an X on the wall on the map. Selma had been X'd out. Wasn't supposed to happen. So, I just finished getting Dion Diamond out of jail, raising money up in Chicago with the Freedom Singers. That's when they made their debut. Their first debut was at McCormick Place. Some of you remember that, okay? In Chicago. Area Crown Theater. I'd gone to Detroit, and we raised some money there. Congressman Conyers helped out and brought us Butler, who was a historian there. They helped to raise the money. And while we were raising the money to get Dion Diamond out of jail, Chuck McDougal, who was the chairman, and Bob Zellner, who just gotten on the staff, they went to visit Dion Diamond, because we didn't believe in leaving folks in jail. You know that. Come hell or high water, we get you out. If we can't get you out, we'll get in with you. And that's what had happened down there in New Orleans. Chuck McDougal and Bob Zellner went down and carried some books and some cigarettes and some fruit and stuff. And the time they got out, they arrested them. You know what they charged them with? Because they were trying to help black folks get registered to vote in Louisiana. They charged them with conspiracy to overthrow the state of Louisiana. That was their interpretation. She said it would work. Why not? Yeah. Yeah. So then we had to raise $30,000. We had to raise $10,000 for Dion Diamond. Now $30,000 for those. We said, we don't want anybody to go visit nobody else right now. We're taking up all our money, you know what I mean? Okay, so now they're out of jail. I come to get my assignment because I was going to drop out of school again. Because my mother always said, you're never going to finish school. And I told her, yes, I am. She said, no, you're not. You ain't going to finish school. So anyway, I dropped out again and, you know, went to get my assignment. And when I got there, the X was on the wall on Selma. So I said, you told me I could be a director of one of these voter registration projects, you know, kind of the scope thing. And they said, we don't have any more assignments. I said, what do you mean? Because, you know, those directorships, you know where the money came from? The Field Foundation. Southern Regional Council was able to get money from the Field Foundation and the Taconic Foundation. Do you know who influenced the Taconic Foundation to give money for voter registration? John, yes, absolutely. That was the unknown there. Mm-hmm. President Kennedy, John Kennedy. He got elected because he had a nice margin of votes from the black community. So he kind of helped to push that along a little bit. Not grandstanding, but anything he could do. So here we were. Also, the reason they gave money for voter registration because they wanted to get all those demonstrators who were going to jail and all that. Well, see, they didn't take into account when you go to rural areas of the South, that's jail material, okay, and being shot and killed. I mean, you know, register in Chicago, someplace like Detroit and all that, that's not a problem, you know that. But you're talking about rural areas, that's direct action. More people got killed, okay, in those rural areas, okay, during that kind of the period of time than, okay, in the voter registration movement than in the direct action movement. And there's a reason why. And you know why. Okay? So, a couple of things, and we'll open up here. The whole idea of going into Selma, Alabama. James Foreman said to me, we don't have any more places. Now, Bill Hansen was the director for Arkansas, and he was our white director of voter registration. Bill Hansen in Arkansas. Charles Sherrod down in Southwest Georgia. All right? So, Selma wasn't on the map anymore. So he said, well, look, we don't have any more places. I said, you promised me if I helped get those folks out of jail that you were going to give me one of these directorships. And I marched behind him, fussing and carrying on. And he said, all right, well, you want to, the only thing left is Selma. We're not going there, but if you want to go take a look at it and see what you think. I said, no, I don't want to go take a look at it. I'll take it. Because see, if it's impossible, you don't have anything to lose. So I'd gone and taken a couple of courses in sociology and everything, and you do research. So I said, this is great. So what I'm going to do is go do some research. I wrote a 50-page paper on Selma before I got there. Yeah. Yeah. You remember Jack Menis? Okay, yeah, he gave the outline and started that whole thing. So that's what I did. I just grabbed some of that material and information, and then I started going down and talking to people. And then what happened is I needed to do some research. So I had to first research where I was going to do my research. So I had to find a library that had some information on mean white folks. Since that was a problem. We already had a lot of information on scared black folks. But why is it that Selma, Alabama, and Bob Moses was in Mississippi? I mean, why would you think that Selma, little old Selma, Alabama, is so bad and folks don't, you can't even get a voter registration drive there? What in the world about the Selma? Well, I had heard about it before because on the Freedom Rides down Highway 80, when you're going from, Montgomery to Jackson, Mississippi, like we were on the Freedom Rides, guess what? We bypassed Selma. Those who were on the Freedom Rides know that. We did not go through Selma. We had the National Guard on the bus with us, going to Mississippi, helicopters, state troopers and everybody. We bypassed Selma. Detour. In other words, we didn't tour Selma. We detoured it. And I talked to the state troopers and later on. You know what happened? They said that there were like 2,000 folks at the bus station waiting on us. They weren't going to confront 2,000 folk. That was all of Jim Clark's posse and all of them type, you know, people like that. You know, those kind of folks. Every male 21 years old belonged to the posse in Dallas County. See, Dallas County, a lot of folks don't know that Selma, the capital of Alabama, wasn't always in Montgomery. The first capital was down there in a place called Cahaba in Dallas County, right there near Selma. It flooded, and they moved it to Montgomery. And do you know what? The white folks in Selma were angrier with the white folks in Alabama than they were the black folks. So you got to understand the subtle psychology. They were mad because they had moved to capital. And even when I got there, I started listening to folks talk, and they said those old dirty, low-down politicians stole our capital. I thought they were talking about money. And I kept listening, and they were talking about the capital. You know? Yeah, the state capital. Yeah. So I got more curious about this thing. And there were some peculiarities about those folks in Selma that was very different. okay? Like, one of the things you might want to take note of is that all those bombings took place down in Montgomery, Alabama. They bombed Martin Luther King's house. They bombed Abernathy's church. By the way, we were on the Freedom Rides. It occurred to me while I was in the church that that was one of the churches that were bombed earlier. So here we are in a bombed church waiting to get bombed again. Oh, Lord. I mean, you know, this, we got to be crazy. Anyway, no bombs in Selma. Look at that. You think they didn't know about dynamite? Birmingham had been bombed. They bombed everything in Birmingham. Okay? So my point is, we have to look at the subtleties. And that's what we need to be able to teach the young people today. To analyze and to be able to see differences and be able to see why things are different and how the differences are accepted. Yeah. Like, for example, this thing didn't come tumbling down, okay, like a wall, segregation. We had to pick it to pieces. We had to pick it to pieces. For an example, on the Freedom Rides, do you know when the Nashville group decided to take up the Freedom Rides and continue them when after the bombing in Anniston, Alabama, and they beat up folks in Birmingham, and they put up, a cooling off period? They said, we're going to cool off until we can get the Alabama Governor Patterson to, you know, to kind of help give some protection to the Freedom Riders. And Nashville said no. Remember? Diane Nash was our spokesperson. John Lewis had been on the Freedom Rides, got off for a little while, got back on. We were ready to go. We dropped out of school, the leaders did, in the midst of our exams. We said, yes, there are exams that have to be taken, and some exams in life have to be taken. And the real exam is, where are you in the midst of a crisis? Are you somewhere bent over some books, studying for some exam, or is it time for you to stand up? The exam of life is more important than any exam or test that you could take. So John Lewis, Jim Bevel, all of us, we dropped out of school. Decided to keep it up. Strike while the iron was hot. Guess what? The other reason we took up the Freedom Ride is because in Nashville, okay, back in 1960, not 61, the Greyhound bus station in Nashville was already desegregated. Yeah. We desegregated that when we desegregated the lunch counters, because the bus station was downtown and had lunch counters. So how are you going to desegregate the lunch counters without desegregating the restroom, okay, and the, waiting room and everything else? That was the only desegregated bus station in the South, was in Nashville, okay? So therefore, we had already desegregated the Greyhound bus station. So you would take a bus during this period from Virginia, come all the way down on a segregated bus, blacks in the back, whites in the front, we mentioned, okay. And then what? When they got to Nashville, you went to integrated bus station. Used the facilities, ate food and everything else. And then you got back on a segregated bus and rode all the way down to Montgomery. To another segregated bus station. However, the people, local folks who came to the Greyhound bus station came on an integrated local bus to come to a segregated bus station to get on a segregated bus. What you do is look for cracks in the system. That's the point I'm making. You look for cracks. Okay, you don't have to go at the whole wall All you need is a crack. Get you a crowbar, okay? And work the crack. Final point, well, in terms of my own involvement, you know, the spring mobilization to end the war in Vietnam, I was the national coordinator of that up in New York. We put 1 million people in the street between California and New York. Mrs. King spoke out there in New York. And Martin Luther King spoke at the UN. And they had sent me up there to get Bevel because he was up there trying to get a ship to go to Hanoi. And they thought I was the only one who could go in there and convince him. And when I got there, Bevel convinced me to stay. So I ended up being the coordinator, right? Okay. So, the Poor People's Campaign, I was the national coordinator of that. And my job, okay, was to bring together all the different ethnic groups, all right? Native Americans, all right? All of those, Chicanos, and we called them in those days, you know, Reyes Tijerina from, Mexico, Corky Gonzalez up there from Denver, and of course, Cesar Chavez. We all met here in Atlanta over at Pascal's. I introduced Cesar Chavez to Martin Luther King. So he had to bring all those people, all right? And so as a result of that, we mounted the Poor People's Campaign. There are more things I can talk about there. But what I want to do now is talk about a concept and why you made the difference. No revolution has ever been won except you're able to win the support, if not the active involvement, of the majority. Yes. You were one of the most significant part of the movement for change. The majority of the British people had to agree to give liberation to India. That was the majority. The majority who held the power. So when the majority moves, it's over. Yeah. So your involvement was no way insignificant. In other words, it wouldn't have happened. All right? We just would have been another tribe someplace, just like we got tribes. All right? And there's some people who advocated that we have our own states. Because every state we got in the United States is really a United Nations. The United States is a nation, okay, of nations. They don't mince words about it when they talk about Native Americans. They call them nations. So this whole idea, you saved us from becoming another, okay, creating another couple of nations someplace. Where are we today? Finally, like I expanded on last night, we are at the end of the second Reconstruction. And we are the ones who have to make the difference. Yes. Don't allow our relationship with the young leaders to be spoiled. It means we have to be patient, we have to listen to them, but we have to help give them counsel and support. We can't be reluctant about that. And what do you think is the best way to give young adult leaders advice? You know what we have to do? Develop the right questions to get them to think. You can't think for them. And the reason I'm talking about this is because I remember doing the movement as a young person, okay? We went through the same thing. And that's why Ella Baker was so effective with us, because she and Connie Curry learn to ask questions. See, well, the only two advisors we had with SNCC, and that was Ella Baker and Connie Curry, and you're going to be hearing from her later on, okay, in this conference. So I just want to say to you, don't detach. They need us now more than ever, because this is going to either make or break where we are. All right? So I just want to leave that with you, and we can have some more discussions about it. But I feel good about this period of time, and I think we're going to be able to overcome the crisis that we're dealing with now, just like we overcame some of the other crises that we had to deal with. But I'm glad you came today, and I'm glad you came yesterday. Thank you.